A couple of weeks ago, we began to look at the paragraph in Luke 8 that starts in verse 40 and goes through verse 56. If you were here for the last couple of weeks, or if you've read over this text recently, you know that it's a story within a story, or a story that contains another story. The big story, apparently, is the story about Jairus and his dying daughter, and Jesus raising her from the dead. And the story within the story is of a woman who came to Jesus who had an issue of blood, and she wanted to be healed, so she snuck up behind him and touched the hem of his garment and was instantaneously healed, and then she slipped back into the crowd hoping that he wouldn't notice. I don't know what that does for your theology or what you think of hers. Oh, he won't see, he won't feel it. Sneaking in there. Story within a story. In our attempts to give significance to that record, we have focused on what appears to be the big issue. To the woman who slipped up behind him, Jesus said, "Daughter, your faith has saved you." And to Jairus, who heard at that point that his daughter had died, Jesus said, "Don't pay attention to that. Don't let your fear get away from you here. Believe me, and your daughter will be saved." So with both of those statements, believe, your faith, we notice that that seems to be the big issue in the paragraph. And when we set that within its context between chapter 8, verse 1, and chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, we realize that Jesus is trying to prepare his disciples to go out and carry on the ministry that he has been doing, and to do that, they're going to have to be able to trust him. They're going to have to believe him. So with that focus in mind, we began to look at the details of the text, and verse 40 we saw was a pivot verse that actually transitions us from the record of the healing or the exorcism of almost 7,000 demons out of Gadarene, a fellow from the land of the Gerasenes or Gadara, in verses 26 through 39. Now, as a transition verse, we're looking for a connection between the two stories, or the two sets of stories. And we notice that there is a fundamental contrast in verse 40 with verse 37. And that is that the people in the land of the Gerasenes wanted Jesus to get out of their country and to leave them alone. They begged him to leave. And in verse 40, the Galileans welcomed him because they'd been waiting for him. Well, that's obvious contrast. And what we decided on the basis of that contrast in this setting was that Luke was trying to show us that if we're going to trust him, we can't have objections to him, either in what he says or what he does. This is a no-objection embrace of faith. It's obvious that you can't trust somebody if you don't like what they say or what they do. It's impossible to be relaxed about what they're going to say and do if you don't like what they're going to say and do, and the essence of faith is accepting what they say and do. So the first element of real faith in Jesus as a disciple who's going to be plugged into the work is that you have to have no objections to him. You can't be upset with the things he says and does. And then with that same focus in mind, we began to look at the man named Jairus in verses 41 and 42, and we found that the seven identifying traits regarding Jairus are closely linked to the demons in the prior paragraph in the land of the Gerasenes. From that we concluded that what Luke is trying to show us is that faith requires a rejection of the kind of attitude that Jairus had lived with and continued to have even up to this point. And that attitude was what I just called a sense of entitlement, where people think they've got more coming to them than they do, or things happen to them and they think they didn't deserve it. This sense of the entitlement to the good life. And that is pervasive among men, but it finds its greatest expression among those who are considered to be powerful. There's this sense that I have a right because I'm powerful. And just because you're not powerful, you don't have the same entitlements that I have. And if you're going to trust Jesus, you got to junk that. That's simply not true. Jesus won't respond to it. He did go to Jairus' house. He did raise his daughter from the dead, but he also told him, I don't want you telling anybody what I've done. So he restricted him from being able to be one of his witnesses because of who he was, because of his background. Now, whether this analysis of the text is legitimate or not, and I hope it is. I hate to spend a couple hours preaching and it all be a bunch of baloney. But if the analysis, even if it's not legitimate, the principles still are. Nobody can believe in somebody with whom they do not like the words or the works. Can't trust them. And nobody can believe in somebody that they simply want to use as a means to their ends. That's all Jairus really wanted. He wanted to use Jesus to get his daughter well, because his life is not wrapped up in Jesus, it's wrapped up in his daughter. So he just wanted to use him. Well, you're not going to find strength of faith with either of those kinds of things, and that's Luke's burden in this chapter, to get us ready to trust in such a way that we can actually do what he wants us to do without conflicts about who he is, what he says, and without trying to use him to get what we want. So that's the background. Now, when we look at the rest of the record, verse 43 and following, we find that faith isn't the only thing that really stands out here. That seems to be the major thesis, but there are two other standout issues in the text. One of them is the problem that calls for the need for and the use of faith. In both cases, there was a major problem. The daughter was dying. The woman was leaking to death, if I can just say it that way. The issue is a need. And in the background of that, there was also the second major standout thing besides faith, and that is the content that identifies the object of the faith. Jesus is identified by Luke as the legitimate content of faith in this double unit. The woman slips up behind Jesus as the object of her confidence, and Jairus gets Jesus to come and raise his daughter from the dead. So Jesus is front and center in the content issue. I believe that the need issue can be summarized as a death focus. The daughter was very near death. The woman that Jesus calls daughter has been leaking her life away for 12 years. She has an issue, a flow of blood that has been going on for 12 years. And Leviticus 17:11 says the life is in the blood. So here she is. She can't possibly be any kind of healthy at all. And it's gradually tearing her down. But when these problems are presented by Luke, the presentation is complicated by his inclusion of the facts that the first daughter, the text says, verse 42, is about 12 years old. And the second daughter, he calls her daughter in verse 48. She's identified in verse 43 as a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years. So you have this 12-year thing that's just stuck in here, deliberately. And then you also have the question that always is going to come up, and that is, why this 12-year thing? Especially for the unnamed woman who has her life flowing out of her little at a time. She's dying degree by degree. And she can pray. Jesus' Father's in heaven. She has access in prayer to God. And I am absolutely sure, though the text doesn't say it, that's pretty dangerous to be absolutely sure when the text doesn't say it, but I'm absolutely sure that she had asked God to heal her. And for 12 years, her prayer went denied. What in the world is the reason for all of that? So this morning, we're going to jump in there. We're going to ask ourselves, what is the significance of the 12 years and why did Jesus let the problems go on for that long? Those are the issues we're going to address. And I want to start with the significance of the number of the years. I want to remind you that it says in chapter 8, verse 27, that Jesus was met by a certain man. He's unnamed. Jairus is named. This man's not. Who was possessed of demons and who had not worn his hamartion for a long time. So here we have a long time. But in the stories that we're given in the next paragraph, the time is identified. The girl's about 12. The woman has had this issue of blood for 12 years. So I want to point out some things about the context that I think will help us with the significance of that number. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that if the girl was 12 years old and the woman had the issue of blood, had had it for 12 years, that the first daughter was born in the same year that the second daughter lost her ability to give birth. I mean, when you begin your cycle as a woman, that's a testimony to you and anybody that knows about it, that you have not conceived, you cannot bear, you haven't been fruitful, your fertility has been denied for that month anyway. And if that never stops, you will never get pregnant. You can't bear if you have this flow of blood for 12 years. So in the same year that the first daughter was born, the second daughter lost her ability to give anybody birth. And that sets up a natural contrast that I think is crucial to the thesis regarding the need for and use of faith. Let me see if I can develop it for you. 12 years before this event was recorded, there was the birth in Jairus' household of a first and only begotten daughter. Now, that she was the firstborn was obvious to Jairus and his wife, but that she was going to be the only one born to them, they didn't know. We're talking 12 years prior to this. So the first and only daughter was born 12 years prior to this record, and on her birth, there was undoubtedly a high rejoicing because of her birth. The reason that I say that is because Luke started this record in chapter 1 dealing with a couple who couldn't have children. And when they did, there was no end to the enthusiastic rejoicing at the birth of John the Baptizer. So that the birth of Jairus' daughter was in deliberate contrast to Luke's opening of the gospel regarding the childlessness of Zacharias and Elizabeth. So what Jairus got, Zacharias and Elizabeth didn't get for years. And Jairus and his unnamed wife had no clue at the time their daughter was born how time itself would gradually compress their hopes and their fears around this one little girl. They had no clue. She was the beginning. She was the first fruit of the womb. She was, as a firstborn, naturally going to have some special... The last time we were in Texas, our daughter dragged out the old projector and slides that we took when we were having kids. And probably 80% of them were of her. And our next born might have got 15% of them. And the third one got maybe 5. It's the way we are. That firstborn is such a high thing in our minds. a time of enormous rejoicing. But at the time when the firstborn's born, unless something happened right then and there to the mom, nobody knows that that's the only child she'll ever have. Jairus and his wife didn't know. And the outcome of that ignorance was that they didn't know that the hopes they had for their children would gradually, over the next years, be forced by the processes of time to focus on this one little girl because there weren't any others. There's another thing they did not know. They didn't know that the great hilarity of celebration that was going on when she was born was going to be brought to an end in 12 years. They didn't know that. They didn't know that they'd put in 12 years of raising and doting on and loving this little girl and then have her taken out of their grip. They didn't know that. So that's one of the elements of the contrast. The first daughter, firstborn, finally realizing that she's the only born that they're going to have. They put all their hopes and fears into this person, this little baby that's growing up. And by way of contrast, in that same year, in another home, another daughter got an indication that she was headed for deep despair. When her cycle started and the blood started leaking out of her, she had no clue that this was going to be any different than any other prior month, except for the fact that she knew she wasn't pregnant, and we don't even know if she expected to be, because we don't know if she was married or not. But when the days kept going, and she couldn't get back to normal, and then a month went by, and she wasn't back to normal, can you imagine how over months and months and months, and then a year, and then 2 years, and then 5 years, and then 12. She didn't know she was headed for this terrible despair, like that recorded in chapter 1 of Luke, verse 5, in respect to Elizabeth the barren. See, we've already been introduced to the problem of not being able to bear. Chapter 1. Way back then. We know from Elizabeth's reaction when she did conceive John the Baptizer that it did some... It caused us to understand some things about the way she had developed as a person. And one of the things that had developed as a person, a married woman who could not bear, was, number one, she had to deal with the fact that the Bible said that if you were following the covenant, you wouldn't be barren. She had to deal with that. And not only she, but then she had to deal with all her neighbors and her friends and her family and all those people who were suggesting that if she'd get right with God, He'd solve this problem of barrenness. So that's the kind of thing that this lady's headed for 12 years before this text, and she doesn't even know it. This unnamed daughter of Jesus, he calls her daughter, lived in a culture where a woman's greatest contribution to life was her fertility. In the scriptures, we run regularly into women who are barren, and we are given regular glimpses into the agony of being a failure as a woman in their hearts and minds. So there she was, headed down that path 12 years ago, but she had no clue that she was beginning a descent into a spiral of uselessness and condemnation. Elizabeth could have told her if she'd have known her, but she had no clue. She didn't know. On the day when her flow began, that it was never going to stop for the next 12 years. So that's the contrast. We have people with expectations and hopes and all of that. And on the one, you have this idea that it's going to be great, and it ends up not being. And on the other hand, this is terrible, and it is for 12 years. But not only is that contrast there in our story, but there is also a very serious reverse similarity in light of Luke's thesis about the need for and use of faith. The only begotten daughter in Jairus' household was going to live for 12 years, and the living was going to create an illusion of hope, an illusion of hope. And she was incrementally moving in this illusion of hope toward the reality, not the illusion. And the reality was that there is this thing called death, and it is remorseless in unveiling the joke of hope that rests on the wrong person. Death will do that. You fix your hopes and your fears, you lock them in on the wrong person, and over time, you'll be able to live with the illusion, this is great. And then death comes in the door and says, I'll show you the truth. And wham! All of a sudden, the hope's gone. The illusion's gone. I had my faith in the fact that I was going to have this little baby girl, and she was going to grow up, and I was going to be able to hold her grandkids on my lap. And I was going to have my life because she had hers. And all of a sudden, death saying, no, there ain't no life there. So that only begotten daughter was going to create an illusion of hope and then destroy it by dying. And the other daughter was going to live for 12 years in the valley of despair, creating an illusion of hopelessness. As the text tells us, she applied all of her resources, and none of it worked. It says in verse 43 that the woman had a hemorrhage and could not be healed by anyone. That means she tried to be. I believe that the text behind the King James actually says that she spent all her resources and none of the doctors could help. Wow. Here you are, slowly bleeding to death, and you're looking for an answer, and you pray and nothing happens. So you begin to use your resources and apply them to whoever and wherever. Go, you know, here and there and everywhere in the attempt to participate in a joy that is rooted in a hope that rests on the wrong idea. Jairus' daughter created an illusion of hope, but that turned out to be a joke because the hope was resting in the wrong person. The woman with the issue created an illusion of hopelessness. It was an illusion. But it was an illusion of hopelessness that was reinforced continuously by the application of her resources to an idea that would bring her joy. And that is, if I can just get rid of this physical thing, if I can be restored to my fertility, if I can get somebody to stop this flow out of my life, if I can just do that, I'll have the joy of life. The wrong idea. In a very real sense, the text is telling us that death is already the adversary. The first daughter was headed for what most people would call an untimely death. She was only 12. And the second daughter was living with death as it chewed away her hope. And so death is already on the scene. And in the one case, it's behind the scenes. In the other case, it's up front and boasting. But in either case, they're both headed for dying. And their experience, though it was in a very sense opposite of each other, it was nonetheless the same because it had to do with death. And I think that makes Luke's point regarding the use of faith. In the stories, faith is supposed to be used to address the reality of the problem of death. It's supposed to be used to apply that to that. How are you going to deal with the reality of death? Everybody's going to die somehow, and if you die when you're 12 or 112, you're still dead. And if your death is a sudden surprise because you've been living with an illusion, or if your death is simply the last thing that happens to your miserable life for all these years, you're still dead. So, how do you exercise faith in the face of the problem of death? Well, let me say this about the use. Luke is showing us how Jesus was preparing his disciples so they could go out and preach the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God, verse 2 of chapter 9. And they're going to have to deal with the real big issue, and that is God's answer to the problem of death. That's why they're going out to preach. It's not about how to get healthy. It's not how to get wealthy. It's not even how to get wise. It's how to deal with the problem. You're going to die. So they need to know how to exercise faith in the face of the biggest problem in this world, and that's death. And then the biggest problem after that is what happens to you after that. And let me say this about that point, because he wants us to believe him. He's trying to show us that Jesus wants his disciples to trust him so that they can handle the details of death in the process of living. Let me say this about faith in light of that. The use of faith is deeply frustrated when the object of faith has been subverted. You trust in the wrong object, and the use of faith, its purpose for being, will be frustrated. It will not work. Death cannot be destroyed, and hear me when I say this. Death cannot be destroyed even by God in the experience of those who insist on placing their faith somewhere else. He cannot stop the impact of death in the life of a person who will not stop trusting the wrong thing or the wrong person. He cannot. That's why Jesus said, you will die in your sins if you don't believe in me. If Jairus persists in putting his hope in his daughter, he's going to discover that that kind of unbelief, and it's a form of unbelief, it's called idolatry, but it's, God can't give me the life I want, but my daughter can. That's the kind of idolatry this is. And not even God can destroy the death that is brought on by that attitude if that attitude doesn't change. So on the one hand, death can't be destroyed even by God in the experience of those who insist on placing their faith somewhere else. But by the same token, great rejoicing as a producer. When the little girl was born, mom and dad were ecstatic. They had produced this little girl, and she was going to be the apple of their eye. They didn't know at the time she was going to be the only apple in their eye. Only begotten. First and last born. And that great rejoicing as a producer, biblically, is supposed to rest in God's gracious use of the production in the lives of those who walk with Him to produce blessing for other people. Rejoicing is not supposed to be in God's provision of blessing that's self-absorbed. God didn't give them that little girl for them to dote on and put all their hopes of life in. That's not why he gave her. Zacharias and Elizabeth rejoiced exceedingly at the birth of their son, but part of their exceptional rejoicing was that they had been told that this son they were going to bear was going to be great in the sight of the Lord, and he would turn many to God. And so their rejoicing was in not only the fact that they were now given a son, but that this son was going to be a useful instrument to God to help other people. And as far as we know, they didn't ever turn that around and start putting all their confidence in John. They didn't start saying, "You're my life, you're my life." God's gifts are never supposed to be subverted into a basis for rejoicing. Never. It is idolatrous to rejoice over something that God gives instead of rejoicing in Him. By the same token, on the other hand, great despair is one who cannot produce, like the woman with the issue, great despair as a useless... That's supposed to be confronted by faith in the fact that God rests His gracious revelation that He determines how He'll use people to bless others, not them. The culture doesn't determine it. When the culture says, if you're a woman and you can't bear, you're useless and worthless and under condemnation, faith says, that's a lie. God is the one who's the master over us. And if He says, okay, I'm going to restrict you from being able to do this or that or whatever that you think is so terribly important, then faith says, all right. It doesn't say, So I believe that this is the reality of that reverse similarity where Luke's point about faith is you need to have it in the right person and in the right ideas. You want to walk with Jesus by faith, you're going to have to walk with Jesus by faith, not using what He gives you as a basis for rejoicing without Him, or despairing over something that He restricts you from when He hasn't restricted you from Himself. Now, if Jesus says, I ain't having nothing to do with you, then go into despair. You deserve to be there. You need to be there, because there is no hope. But Daryl, you haven't dealt with this 12-year thing yet. I don't think that Luke told us that the girl was about 12 and that the woman had been suffering this hemorrhage for 12 years just because he thought it was a good idea. I really don't think that he told it merely to identify the point at which these two daughters' lives began to intersect. I mean, it's possible that that's his only point, that the girl was about 12 and the lady had had this issue for 12 years, and so they were, you know, they started their journeys at the same time in opposite directions, one toward an illusion of hope in the wrong person and the other in a despair because of confidence in the wrong idea. I don't think that we need to dismiss that idea because it's obviously here, but I also do believe that he told us about the 12 because of how important 12 is. In the Bible, 12 is a widely used number for a purpose, and that is to address the idea of here is a summary presentation of a highly developed complexity. The New Jerusalem, where we're all headed if we're trusting in Jesus, is a city of perfect relationships. It's got four walls around it, and there are three gates in each wall, which makes 12 gates. And under the walls of the city, the foundation of the walls and the rest of the city, there are 12 foundation stones. And when you develop that whole issue of foundation stones and the colors and the tribes and of Israel that they represent, all of that stuff, when you develop all that, you discover that there is an enormous complexity here that is represented by a city that has 12 foundation stones and 12 gates. the 12 means something. When Jesus decided that he would summarize the ministry of the church by selecting out of all of the hundreds of disciples that were, thousands perhaps, that were following him around, he would select a group that he would call his apostles and he would specially train them. You know how many he chose? 12. When God decided to develop a nation from a man so that it could be his showcase to the world, he made it up out of tribes that descended from one man, and there were 12 of them. The issue of 12 is complicated in the Bible, but it boils down to the fact that it is a presentation of a highly complex reality, and this presentation is an adequate statement of the complexity without all the complexity. It's just a summation, but it's an adequate one. And so the implication of 12 in our record is that both daughters actually represent an adequate picture of the twin problems of unbelief. The two problems of unbelief. One of them is the problem of the mountain of arrogance, and the other is the problem of the valley of despair. You've heard these terms for 6 years now, and maybe before that. But the fact is, we walk with God by faith when we are not living in a mountain of arrogance in our own minds, by putting our confidence in what we've produced, and we're so happy and we think this is life, and she's not. She's headed to death. And we are walking by faith when we reject the notion that if I could just get my ability to show my culture how much I could accomplish, then I'd be happy. That's the wrong idea. There's no life there. The entire direction of Christianity in America has been subverted by a whole host of theologians who flat out tell you that the reason that they have done most of the scholarship work that they've done is to try to get the world to recognize that Christianity rests on really good scholarship. If that's not status lust, I have never seen it. All that is trying to show everybody how smart we are and how we've got it all figured out and how our answers will answer everything. And you know what? The world's still not impressed. It's impressed by those who have no qualifications, but it's not really impressed by qualifications. So in our record, there are two daughters. Both of them are wrapped around this 12th thing. And one of those daughters lives in a house where she's the prima donna. She's the source of life for daddy and mama. I could be a poet. That's arrogance. That's idolatry. Look what we produced and we're so happy. And in the other house, there is a woman whose life is leaking away and she can't produce anything that the culture says is significant, so she's in this terrible despair. These two female persons, called daughters, represent the problem, adequately in summary. The arrogance of the synagogue and the arrogance of the rulers of the synagogue. Look how important I am. I get to sit in the chief seat. I'm a ruler. Rest in Jairus' case upon his delusion that his life comes from having a daughter. It's wrong. That's not where his life comes from. She is a phenomenal gift to him, but he subverted her into an idol. She didn't cause it. He did. But nonetheless, that's the arrogance of the rulers of the synagogue, and Jairus was one of them. The despair of the unnamed daughter in her infertility rests upon her delusion that life comes from being able to produce. That's not true either. If life comes from being able to produce, that poor guy on the cross that died, he wasn't able to produce anything, so he didn't get any life, right? Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. He didn't produce anything. He just got right into paradise that day. If he didn't get any life when he got there, you and I aren't reading the same Bible. The problems that these two issues of pride and despair represent are there, and they're there in the text. You see, the law under which their culture operated was very adamant that if you lived by the law, you would not be barren. Exodus 23:26 commits the Lord your God to the provision of fertility for everyone who serves him across the board. Exodus 20:12 commits the Lord thy God to the provision of long life for those who honor their parents. And that young lady's dying at 12. So anybody that takes the law and applies it to those situations are going to say, uh-oh, we got a mad God here. He is upset. Any breakdown in the requirements and provisions of the law were indicators of fault at the requirement side of the coin. God didn't fail. It was the people who failed. And this is, hear me here, this is the major obstacle to faith. When your circumstances have brought you to the point where you have to recognize, I failed. That is the last point you think that you need to be in to be able to live a life of faith. But it's the first. We can live by faith when we're willing to junk the sense of entitlement, which is basically junking the sense of, I've never failed, I deserve. No. God never responds to that. The only people God has ever savingly responded to are people who have come to him and said, I am a total failure. Will you forgive me? So instead of being a hindrance to faith, the failure of being able to live up to the law was actually a school teacher to bring us to faith. And so Luke's thesis that you need to exercise faith is a thesis that the need for it is your failure and Jesus is the answer. You trust him regardless of whether you failed or not. In fact, since you have failed, you trust him because he's the answer to the death that's coming on you for your failures. Now that brings us to the hardest question of all, and I'm about out of time, so I should just blow it off, right? How come God waited 12 years to do this? We all know that God could... He didn't even have to do that. And the problems would be solved. And everywhere we turn in the scriptures, we're told that God is powerful and he could do this kind of stuff. And we're shown in the Bible that he could. This lady didn't say a word to Jesus. She slipped up behind him and touched the hem of his garment with her fingertips and then backed away. How come it took 12 years to get there? What about your situation? Some of you have been waiting for more than 12 years for God to exercise his power for something you've wanted. And how come he waits so long? For human beings, one of the major problems we face is what appears to be the arbitrariness of God. On one hand, we say, well, if God's going to solve the problem, why didn't he just do it? And on the other hand, we say, well, if he's not going to solve the problem, why didn't he just go ahead and drop the hammer instead of just letting it drag out and get worse? You identify with either one of those? That's what we call the appearance of the arbitrariness of God. Let me warn you, though, all this morning we've been talking about illusions and reality. I really believe that the revelation of this text of the problems is also a revelation of the answer. One of the reasons for God's timing is altogether bound up in what he's trying to do. Do you know that nothing is done instantaneously except miracles? Yeah, miracles, you can go and it's done. For the rest of us, it's slog it on, you know, until finally. You want a brand new 6-speed Corvette? There are two ways to get one. One, start by buying the parts and putting them together. Well, I mean, there are several ways of getting one, but that's, you can start with the details. If General Motors wasn't owned by the government, you could ask them to build it for you. But at any rate, that's the hard way. The easy way is to say, God, you said in your word, anything I'd ask, it'd be mine. Right here, right now. And boom, there'd be. Right? It'd be a miracle, wouldn't it? I mean, if God put a new Corvette right here, we wouldn't even be able to get it out the door. It cost us an arm and a leg just to get it on the street. What a mistake. I should have asked for it out there in the street. My point is, only the miraculous is instantaneous. By definition, a miracle is a process-less power event. The word translated miracle many times in the scriptures is actually the word dunamis, means an act of power. But it's a process-less act of power. It doesn't require all the stuff. The guy who's lame from his mother's womb, all of a sudden he can jump and holler and he looks like a kangaroo. How did he learn to walk? You don't need to learn when it's a miracle. Done. By definition, then, a miracle is a processless power event, but also by definition, it's an out-of-the-normal event. If it was happening every day, you'd get so used to it that it would lose its identity as a miracle, not in the sense that it wouldn't require the power and it might be even instantaneous. But if it happens every day, you know what happens to people who see the same thing happen over and over and over and over and over? It loses its ability to impress you. If you see somebody raise somebody from the dead and that's the only time in your whole life you see it, you're impressed. But if every day you live, you know, you're the you're the guy that runs the funeral home. And there's this guy that lives next door. And every time you get a customer, he comes in and raises him from the dead. And there goes your profit. And in a little while, you're so angry with him because he's messing with your income. You don't care whether people are suffering because somebody died. That's not the issue. The issue is he's messing with my income. Would you please get out of here? That's the gathering. That's the garrison. You caused our hogs to all die. Would you leave? But the fact is, miracles by definition are acts of power designed to impress. And why does God want to impress anybody? Because it is only by impressing us that He can get us to actually buy into the truth at a level that will actually change us. If I'm not impressed enough, I'm not going to believe Him. And if I don't believe Him, my life's not going to be changed by Him. So getting people to the point where the impression will actually change them is a very complex and time-consuming process. It took 4,000 years for the fullness of time to develop to the point where God could send His Son into this world and actually affect redemption and be believed for it. 4,000 years! What does that mean? It means the problems are profound. So when you say, well, why does God wait so long to do what He's doing? Well, He's not waiting, doing nothing. He's working in the details to get us ready for the impression that will change us. So that's part of the answer. The other part is in this record is this fact. People don't have a problem with God's timing unless they don't like what He's doing. And if they don't like what He's doing, guess what? Their problem is a lack of love and understanding like God's. And if you have a problem with what God's doing or how He's going about it, you're actually saying, I have a better method. I have a better way. I could do it better. And what is that? That's the devil saying, I'm going to take the throne. Well, nobody who's really embraced the truth of God's love has any problem with what he does or doesn't do. If Job had understood how often God was going to use his testimony in the lives and hearts of people who were suffering and needed the witness of his testimony, if he'd understood how often in the next thousands of years God was going to use the testimony of Job, his conflict with God would have been if he really wanted to be a servant of God. Since God doesn't shy away from the cost that is involved in the painful realities in bringing us up to the point where the impression can be made that will actually redeem us and change us. Since God doesn't shy away from the cost, it cost him Jesus. Nobody who really wishes to be a servant is going to shy away from the cost either. So the very fact that people say, I don't like the way God waits so long, tells us that he hadn't gotten his work done with them yet. If people are so reluctant to embrace him in a reciprocating kind of love, that proves that the difficulties are so profound that it's going to take a while. We can be glad that it only took 12 years in this case. There was another lady in this book who Jesus said had been bound by Satan for 18 years. You think 12 is bad? The fact is, however, that God does all things well in the lives of those whom he has set his affection on and who return it. And we're not going to have a problem with what he's doing if we believe that. We're only going to have a problem with it if we don't. And Luke is dealing with the disciples of Jesus and his training of them so that they can go out and preach this message. And before they go, they need to have this under their belt. And the same thing's true of you and me. We've got lives to live. We've got days to get through. We've got events that we're going to have to face and deal with. We've got some high periods of joy coming, and we've got some low periods of disaster, grief, pain. Are we going to trust him? Let's pray. Father, we know that above many of the things that are said in your word, that one of the things that is said high on the list is that you want us to believe you. So we pray that you would grant us the grace to be so convinced of your love and your wisdom that we can believe you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.